Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking about LibreOffice, but LibreOffice online. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 497, recorded September 13th, 2018, LibreOffice Online. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and totally unaware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with. Today is probably going to be one of those. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Dan Lynch. Welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back.
And I suspect you're somewhere near Liverpool, unless you moved recently.
No. Well, I'm in my studio. So I'm on the outskirts of Liverpool in the UK, which people may detect from the accent, although I'm not going full kind of Ringo Starr today. I'll be like, Randall, tell us about this project.
Awesome. Hey, so, and I am back at my monthly jaunt to ZipRecruiter, and I'm in a different beach location this week. Conference rooms on the first floor are named after beaches, local beaches. And this one is Pismo. As you can actually see, because if you're seeing the video, you can actually see it up in the upper right-hand corner. It wasn't possible when we were in Manhattan a month ago because Manhattan Ward was way over on the edge, which is off the screen. So anyway, so I'm in Santa Monica, which is great because I have 1 gigabit of bandwidth when I'm here. And I'm hardlined on a Cat 6 cable, and so everything is wonderful. So today's topic is LibreOffice Online. So many of you out there are very familiar with LibreOffice. You're probably running it on your desktop or whatever, and so you can edit documents not only in the Office format, but also I think it imports quite a few things. I don't actually use it. It's on my Mac, but I rarely fire it up except when somebody sends me an ODT file or something. So what this is it's a well, I can actually read it. If I scroll to the right place. Randall, show prep. Next time, remember, show prep. Here we go. So it's a future HTML5-based, cloud-based version of the Office Suite. So is this just an Office script written in JavaScript? No, it's actually brought to you in your browser in a new and interesting way, and there's many good reasons not to duplicate all the existing C++ code. So what they did is they sort of put a thin veneer, as far as I understand it, of JavaScript code that can talk to most of the existing code, so they can still share the same code base between mobile and desktop, and then now the web. And it's still in its infancy. I was rather disappointed this morning. I wanted to play with it, and it says, just download this Docker image, and there's no Docker image by that name. So I was like, okay, now what am I going to tell people to do after the end of this show? Because it's not there. Maybe you can get it the other way. It's like a Linux package manager or something like that. But I know that's missing so far. So what do you know about this, Dan?
I haven't used this version, I've got to be honest. So I'm interested to see what's happened with this version. But I've used it as part of Nextcloud, which some people will know. It was embedded in Nextcloud. So I've used it on that version, and it was very good. And I'm interested to hear how it's developing and talk about some of the deployment things as well. And there's some other issues as well, which I think we'll probably get into. But we should probably let Michael talk about some of those.
Yes, I'm mentioning that. That's Michael Meeks, who's going to be today's guest coming on. He works at Collabora, one of those. We were debating that before the show, so we don't know how it's pronounced. He'll be talking to us about that and talking to us about how Collabora has been basically funding this, producing this, making most of the commits, and all sorts of wonderful things. But before we do that, we do have an important message. Because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with droplets, virtual machines that are a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from the standard or CPU-optimized droplets and customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. The easy-to-use control panel and API lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Industry-leading price to performance. Access the compute resources you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you pay per month with a flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Included at no additional cost, 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, and easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including mine, and some of the world's fastest-growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/floss. That's do.co/FLOSS for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring Michael on. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Good to see you. Excellent.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking also, like Dan, from the United Kingdom, near Cambridge.
Ah, Cambridge. I was up there at the university once for a genetic conference because Pearl was heavily involved in genetics, and I was up there and got to see the university there. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, so tell us what's the 50,000 foot view? What is LibreOffice Online as opposed to just say LibreOffice?
Sure. So I think we put LibreOffice effectively into your browser, and that gives you loads of different advantages. So it's very easy to manage, so you can deploy it very easily, obviously, to all your users. And that's actually really important when it comes to document standards. So maybe we can talk about that in a bit. But in the past, if you've sent a document to someone, they can complain that they can't open it. There are all sorts of complaints in the world. But if you send them a URL, if they can't open the URL, they don't have a browser, and there's probably a more basic problem with them. So so hopefully this sort of enlarges the scope of people that can see and collaborate with you around documents. And I think the other key thing is collaborative editing, I think, that.
So that's collaborative editing, sort of like the way Google Docs does it, where two people can actually be editing the document at the same time?
Absolutely, exactly that. So you'd see two users' cursors or multiple users' cursors. I mean, there's no formal limit to scalability. I imagine it gets slow when you are above 20, 30 users, this kind of thing, depending on your hardware. But yeah, so you see their selections, you see their presence. There's some nice features there too, like following the editor. So you can select who you want to follow. And often we find in meetings, there are lots of people, 20 people on a call, but one of them is really minuting and the others are just checking it sane and tweaking things and improving stuff and maybe reading ahead or writing ahead. And so, it's a nice feature. So yes, great collaboration. And I think people are willing up to give up a lot for collaboration. I mean, if you look at the wiki revolution, the wiki threw away WYSIWYG editing. For everybody, you couldn't see what it was going to look like. You had terrible formatting tools. Actually, probably appealed to developers a lot, these sort of markdown style of, editing. But you could collaborate and your documents lived on the internet somewhere, and that was great. And so, of course, we could bring that collaboration and now rich document editing as well. So it's kind of a beautiful thing.
So one way to compare this would be saying it's something like what Google Docs is providing us, but we have control of the source code instead of Google having it locked up in a proprietary place.
Absolutely. And I think that's another really key point, like having it on premise so you can control it. You own your data. It never even leaves your network, potentially. And that's even more interesting when you start to look at things like Spectre and some of these CPU vulnerabilities. It's not just that you own your data, because you can encrypt in all sorts of ways, but actually as it's manipulated, it's running on your hardware and your safe network. Your data is not being routed via, from Ireland through Taiwan and back into where you are or whatever, that might cause you a concern. And also, who's running on the same machine. So if you use someone else's cloud hosting environment, sometimes, there's a certain degree of over-provisioning or lots of virtual machines often on the same hardware. And how secure is the hardware? It's an interesting question. So I think, it's just nice to know that you've got control of everything. It's all on your premises. And so a bank or hospital or someone that's deeply concerned about privacy and ownership of the data can own that and be fully confident. They control everything. They own everything. Run it on your own hardware and enjoy.
And so I presumed that every member of this audience is fully aware of what LibreOffice is, but let's run through it. What components does it have? It's like a document editor, spreadsheet. Sure. What else?
Absolutely. So it's a really good question. So LibreOffice has a whole load of different components, from databases through formula editing and various other scripting things in between, macros, VBA compatibility. Some of those things aren't there yet in online. So we focus primarily on the spreadsheet, the word processor, and presentations as of now. And while you can do some macro scripting, we kind of turn that off for various reasons. So helps secure things.
Now let's talk a little bit. Let's get a little geeky here. Let's talk about the technology then. Did I describe it accurately?
Yeah, pretty good actually. Yeah. So I think from a scalability perspective, we are real lovers of the Unix fork system call. So so one of the things we do, I don't know if you've launched LibreOffice, particularly on a hard disk system, if you can remember those, many of them are still out there. It takes significant time to start LibreOffice, and that's a bit of a downer. And it's quite weighty just for one user. There's a lot of functionality there, 8 million lines of code, 150 meg of stuff, and then it can start to interoperate and render beautiful things and so on. But of course, much like enterprise Java, if you run a Java application, you have a similar experience. It takes forever to start, and then it just says hello world or something. But certainly on the web server, we run these things up, and then once it's started, it's then relatively efficient. It's all done in threads, or in our case, processes. So we launch and initialize LibreOffice, we load all the fonts, all the dictionaries, all of the configuration, the heavy startup. All of the code is pre-linked as well. Actually, it's not pre-linked, it's dynamically linked, and then we share all of that. So there's an LD binds now thing, if you want to be really geeky. So all sure. of the code is there ready to go, and then we can fork, and we're just it's really snappy to load the document. So you do the document load, it's hard to do that ahead of time without the data, but everything else should be raring to go. And so, it's efficient, and because of all that sharing, we can then get the per document memory use down to about 50 meg, which is not too bad for obviously if you embed DVDs in it and giant images, it's going to be bigger. But for a reasonable average for documents, I think that's quite good.
And how did this get started?
Well, that is a good question. So we had this design for a long time. Actually, the very first LibreOffice conference in Paris, we're using a thing called GTK Broadway, which uses a similar approach. Alexander Larson made that for Red Hat, and it just kind of showcased what was possible. And we were then just looking for people to fund it, really. I think one of the problems with, of course, free software is how do you fund it? And we found a company eventually called IceWarp that were very interested in this model and helped kickstart that with Calabra. And we invested a lot in this. And, Calabra's continued to put a large amount of money into this to try and, make it something really awesome for people. People have wanted it for a long time. And, we want to deliver that freedom for people.
And how did you get involved?
Oh, how did I get involved? In free software, in LibreOffice, in OpenOffice?
LibreOffice.
Back in the day, rewinding. So my career started when my mother taught me to program on the BBC Micro. But a bit after that, I was at university. And I became a Christian in my gap year. And one of the things, it's funny, isn't it? How God puts his finger on one thing and says that thing. And that's, of course, the thing you don't want to change. But in this case, everything was stolen on my computer. My compiler, my operating system, all non-free software. And so very reluctantly, I used Linux instead initially. And then, it killed my hardware, the first lot of hardware. And then after that, things got better, and it turned out to be really cool. And, software freedom bit me very, very early, thankfully, due to that. And so, GCC rejected my patch. Actually, they just didn't bother replying to my patch for about 3 years. So I moved on to GNOME, and GNOME needed an office suite. So I reverse engineered Excel files for fun, and I worked on a thing called Numeric with Miguel de Casa, who was famous. And that was fun. And then eventually Sun came along and said, hey, well, we've just bought this Star Division thing. We want to open source it. Which bit should we keep and which bit should we, chuck? And so just got involved with OpenOffice at that stage, tried to fuse it into GNOME, and eventually SUSE spun us out into Calabra Productivity, really. So there's a team at SUSE, and SUSE realized that perhaps mobile, cloud, Office, PC, Windows stuff wasn't a great fit for a Linux company. And they were just very, very good about it, really, really good. Huge respect for their management. They spun us out, and they did good by us. And better still, they focus the company. And I think, you know, Nils, who runs SusanAZ, just doing a great job making that a profitable open source business in a really good way. So that's pretty much the story of Calabra productivity. LibreOffice, of course, came out of OpenOffice when, we didn't see things improving under Oracle stewardship. They've been bad for a while. But that's pretty much that, I guess. I've been involved for quite a long time now, free software and documents particularly.
So, Michael, tell us a bit about what, we'll get back to LibreOffice very, very shortly, but Calabra does other stuff, don't you? You do stuff with media codecs, is that right? You do stuff with video codecs and so on?
Absolutely. So Calabra is the parent company. So Calabra Productivity is a subsidiary. It's half owned by myself and also half owned by Calabra. But parent company is, 13 years old now, the lucky age. And does all sorts of things. So Linux kernel enablement. I mean, we do really cool stuff, augmented reality. We do, Linux distributions, hardware enablement, in-vehicle stuff, airplanes, anything. But basically, our mission is to make open source succeed. And, make it the de facto standard in the industry. Philippe, my co-director, has got the raison d'être, our reason to exist is to make open source really a rock. So we're a floss company through and through. Everything we do is open source. But the Calabra parent company is a consultancy. So and productivity is trying to be a product company. And Calabra's really growing fast. It's actually exciting. If you look at our mission in 2005, it seemed ridiculous 13 years ago to make open source the industry standard for development. And now it looks less so, which is good. And we hope that with more and more work and getting into more and more companies, and I wish I could tell you all of the names of these people. So we work for AMD, for Intel, and ARM. So, if it makes chips, we do it. And we do Linuxy things with it. And we're hiring, awesome. So we love to get new people in kernel, graphics, multimedia, virtual reality, or AR even. Join us. We're hiring. There's a web page somewhere with jobs listed.
Awesome. Awesome. That sounds brilliant. That sounds really, really good. And I do know Calabra does loads of stuff. I just wanted to kind of work that in there. So meanwhile, at LibreOffice, I suppose, we should one thing I want to talk about, I mentioned it in the intro, is my intro. Well, so I've used LibreOffice on my desktop for as long as it's been around, and before that, OpenOffice. I don't have your history in free software or open source software, but I went full-time Linux desktop in about 2005. So it was around the same time. My experience of LibreOffice in a browser online came through Nextcloud. So what's your link with Nextcloud and how's that work for you?
that's a great question. So actually, if you look at LibreOffice online or Calabra online, I just got online, you discover that it's kind of like a microservice. It's like the biggest microservice you've ever seen, but it actually is stateless. So it stores all of its data, all your documents somewhere else. And it also doesn't do authentication, really. So authentication is done by someone else, too. There's a protocol called WAPI, which comes out of Microsoft, that ties those two things together, so storage and authentication. And we extend it in some ways to make it work nicely with Nextcloud, OwnCloud, Pydio, C-File, eGroup, where, there's just a large number of people. And part of what we do, or part of what I do, is a sort of a business function of going out there and evangelizing the code and getting people to integrate it and build it into their software and OEM it. We work with Dell, for example, and just getting them shipping it out there to as many people as they possibly can. Obviously for financial reasons, but just, driving that open source goodness out there. Mm. So by itself, of course, the thing doesn't do much. It's an iframe that sits in another application. So Nextcloud or OwnCloud, great choices of applications to work with there, host your own enterprise file sync and share. And there's some real gems there. I mean, if you haven't played with those, I really recommend looking at them just to, control your own data. And I think more excitingly is the sort of federation thing that you can do there. So you can have your own Nextcloud instance, for example, and you can federate with a Pydio instance or an OwnCloud instance, and you can share files and share data between them in a really quite interesting ways, again, securely. It's great. So we love to go to market with these people.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to chat to you a bit about deployment because one of the issues that seems to come up, the perennial issues, there was actually a big discussion about this at OggCamp, an event that I'm involved with recently, where somebody said that they wanted to get all of their coworkers off, say, Google Office services and onto LibreOffice online. And the discussion that came out of that was the fact that somebody needs to host it. So Is there any plans to kind of link with, or I suppose companies could do this anyway, but what I'm trying to get to here, there is a question at the end of this, is you know, what about hosting? Because for people who maybe aren't confident in hosting their own servers and things, could they go and, you know, get a service, maybe even pay a little for the service and, you know, just use the service?
Absolutely. And so we have a number of hosting partners, some of whom have products that they're announcing or have announced. And, you know, so Nuon Off is a partner of ours we work with a lot, and they have a Midgeon Cloud thing you can use. But there are a list of those on our website in terms of the partners and their details. And, of course, we encourage people to do that. It makes it easier for people. I think one of the nasty configuration things is that everyone knows we need to be secure and we need everything encrypted and so on. Mm-hmm. But go away and try and create an SSL certificate, you know, register a domain name, create an SSL certificate that's valid, and then configure, you know, your web server and Collabra Online to use it is a non-trivial enterprise. And that's really quite sad. So you're in this sort of tension between, well, I don't know. And of course, we implement HTTP ourselves. So we are effectively another web server. Of course, a very simple one. We set up a WebSocket, and then the rest is just not very interesting. It's just sending bits down the WebSocket. But, you know, still, it's another web server, and so that, yeah, it can be just a bit annoying to set up. But on the plus side, we don't require a database. We don't require a, you know, there are plenty of other problems with setting up, you know, web services. So, yeah, thankfully, the Docker image does work. I'm surprised it doesn't work for Randall, because it is claimed that it works. Let me just check. I'm
It's not there.
Over, you
know. It's not on Docker.
It's not on Docker Hub.
Yeah.
Jolly well ought to be on Docker Hub.
That's where it looks.
It's like, yes, we've had something like 6.5 million downloads of it or something, or nearly 7 now, I think. So, it must be there somewhere. I don't know whether either that or we're just looking at a random number generator for the.
Maybe
it's
a bad link.
It's not a Collabora / code, which is exactly what I cut and pasted that. I didn't even type it that time. I cut and pasted it right into my document and it just didn't work. It's
Docker
not there.
Code image. Yes, code is such a terrible name to use for anything.
Yeah.
But if I look at hub.docker.com, r collabora /code, it is there, you know? So hub.docker.com /r/collabora/code.
What?
So it's probably your gigabit connection, Randall. It's like disconnected at the wall, you know, and, you know, you've got a scissory.
You know what? I made the same mistake. I left out the O.
Collabora has an O in it. Never mind. Yeah. I think it's a great name, though, and highlighting our collaborative something or other. I was just thrilled that, you know, Philippe had founded a company, you know, 7 years before we needed it that had the perfect name. So, you know, this is good news.
Awesome. Yeah. And seeing as we're talking about deployment and Randall's grabbing the Docker image probably as we speak, you mentioned there's no need for a database. So, and it's its own web server, but would you use like a Nginx or something as a proxy then, or you know, a reverse proxy?
So that's a really good question. So I think often you want, depending on your setup, for like a home user, I think just a simple... it's really, really hard to say. I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to standardize on the existing web server doing an SSL unwrap using the certificates and just forwarding it to us over HTTP. I think that's probably the cleanest way that reuses your existing setup. And I think we're going to be doing some packaging to make that even easier for people and make that kind of the recommended way to do it. Of course, if you want to scale this to a large number of users, we say about 10 users per thread. On a piece of hardware, so I don't know, my current machine here's got 8 threads, so it's about 80 people. But if you're, you know, wanting more, and these are concurrent users, you know, I don't know how many 80s of people you get concurrently using stuff. As you said earlier, Randall, you don't know how often you use this stuff. You're always, and even in offices, I get the feeling that lots of office workers are busily doing business research on news.bbc.co, you know, this kind of thing, much of the day. And not typing studiously into their office suites. But certainly, when you have multiple users using it concurrently, it can help to have an HA set up and just spread that load across multiple machines. That's pretty easy to do with HA proxy or F5 or...
Oh. You mentioned encryption as well. So I've been doing some of this stuff lately with some other services. I was setting up on a home server. And I've basically lived in, well, not lived in, but I've seen to be using Let's Encrypt like 10 times a day, because you can you can really, you know, generate your own certificates now. If people don't know about Let's Encrypt, they should check that out, because the EFF's doing great stuff there and actually improving the amount of traffic that is HTTPS on the internet through Let's Encrypt. So deployment, I know we're talking about how easy this is, and I've already made the point that it's not easy for everyone, but it shouldn't be that hard to deploy compared to, you know, any other web service, I suppose.
Right. I think that's the thing. And you do spend lots of time in Let's Encrypt generating certificates and so on. But when you come down to a home user, you know, if you're going to pop it in your home, like your NAS box or something, then typically the security environment is kind of weird. And are you going to get a valid... You need a self-signed certificate, I suppose. And we ship with those, I think, in the Docker image. You just need to trust it. But self-signed certificates. Let's Encrypt is the right answer, I think. But again, you need a reasonable host name and, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure anybody who can get to the stage where they're worrying about, like, you know, Let's Encrypt and stuff is probably sufficiently knowledgeable enough to kind of go that little bit further and learn that bit, I would assume, which is interesting. Have you got, so obviously most, as I mentioned, a Linux user, most Linux distributions come with LibreOffice, the old, you know, the offline one, embedded. Sure. So if I were to try and install, say, Ubuntu server or a Debian server, is there any packages that I could add where it would add the online element for me or to the hosting bit, maybe without Docker? People will be dropping their drinks around here now, but I'm not mad about Docker, I'll be honest. I prefer
I'm not mad about Docker either, but it seems to at least provide an environment that that some people, well, it's trendy anyway, that's the thing, you know. But give me an old-fashioned package, that would be my preference. And so we provide package repositories as well on the code page. They're there as well for all the popular Linuxes. And of course, you can build your own. I mean, we encourage people to get involved, build it, compile it, play with it, send us patches, do fun stuff with it. That's really the ideal thing.
Yeah. I'm really shocked that Randall isn't using the BSD jail for this, to be honest. I recently had a discussion with someone about how, in my humble opinion, you know, a lot of this Docker stuff is like BSD jails or Chroot or something with a lot of marketing around it and some added tools, but.
It is exactly that. A lot of marketing.
and a really cool logo. I love the whale. The whale logo is awesome. That helps a lot.
The whale logo is awesome. And it's extraordinary what you can do with a very simple technology. But then again, you know, Web 2.0 was a single API call in the browser, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the an asynchronous do stuff method and tell me when you're done. You know, that was Web 2.0. Amazing. And the books and the conferences and the, you know, I don't know. So, yes. Out of small things, wonderful complexity and richness can, well, that's maybe true. Grow. I don't know. Particularly that's in the modern area.
Can I interject for a second for tech support? What is a WAPI host, WOPI?
What is a WAPI host? So I think at this point, Randall, you've realized that you need a Nextcloud, OwnCloud, PyDOC file installed as well, right? Like one of these.
What?
You know,
what?
I know. I know, exactly. It's just too bad. So if you have one of these already, it's then very easy to use. And so, So there's some nice pages on Nextcloud.
I've got it to fire up, but of course it wouldn't do anything because it's not finding the
exactly. Copy. Exactly. It's waiting for some data and some authentication and this kind of thing to do anything fun.
The first container it created was Nostalgic Wozniak. Anyway, sorry, go ahead, Dan.
About the Docker thing you said, though, Dan, was that we use actually a similar approach of containerization inside. So, you know, all of our documents are loaded in a separate chroot. So I mentioned this big forking process. The forking process forks, and then it chroots, and it installs a whole lot of setcomp, you know, these BSD network filters. I don't know if you've seen the setcomp stuff. It's the Berkeley packet filters, actually. And you filter all your system calls so that, you know, you can only do simple system calls. Nothing that was dodgy, no weird NUMA memory movement stuff that's had vulnerabilities in it in the past. So you can really constrict what can be done in that jail. And, of course, the documents live each in their own jail. So, it's nice to use the similar tools to lock everything down and make sure it's reasonably, if anything gets out, despite our work, you know, you end up inside an environment with no shell, no binaries you can run in it, unable to ptrace or, you know, there's there's so little you can do in there. There's really nothing. There's just some fonts. So, you know, if you want access to your own document and some fonts, knock yourself out. Break out of the, you know, break out of the
awesome. Yeah, this has been on my mind recently because I'm going to name drop now a bit, but someone that you probably will both know, I was chatting to Alison Randall recently about this. She's doing some research in Cambridge, funnily enough, about about how
for meals occasion. You know,
there you go. Then. So has she talked to you about the fact that containers and VMs are essentially the same thing? Because that was what the talk she gave that I saw, which was brilliant, and we had a good chat about it afterwards. Anyway, we're getting way off topic now. So meanwhile, back in the LibreOffice topic, in our IRC channel, people are asking questions, and we've got a question from Emily Destrange, who says, a big question for me is, does it auto-save periodically? Because I've lost too many documents without having the auto-save established.
Yes, and the answer is exactly yes. So in a future world, it would be wonderful to save every keystroke and operations, you know, composable operations and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is, as of now, it saves pretty much every minute. So you shouldn't lose more than a minute of data. And we work really quite hard to make that so. Again, if you use something like Nextcloud, OwnCloud, you have a versioning system behind that as well. So every time you save, you can see other versions. And that's expired in a generational way. So there's some, you know, three versions in the last 5 minutes and 10 versions in the last hour. And, you know, I don't know, it tails off over time. And that works that works pretty well.
So. Cool. Excellent. Well, that's good that we could answer that one then. So hopefully, Emily, that's allayed your fears about that. I do know lots of people, I mean, the bad old days of using programs which wouldn't auto-save, I think we all remember. And, you know, I've lost some work that way. But you only do it once, or hopefully you only do it once, and then you learn to just OCD, just keep going Control-S, Control-S, Control-S,
yes. If you like. So I think the other thing that I learned when I was very young was that you can save a lot of power by turning off the hard disk, you know, flush thing. So it's like an hour long. But you can also lose a lot of data as you sit on the train and type for however long. And so I now type sync in every shell I see. And Richard Storm once said to me, you know, a shell is like a ship. It either lists or it sinks, you know. So these terrible Unix jokes.
Yes.
What can you do?
Yeah, very true. So some of the underlying stuff I'm interested in as well. We talked a bit about deployment. What kind of requirements are there? You said you don't need a database. So what would I need to run it on?
Well, that is a really So essentially, just a Linux operating system. I'm sorry, there's no BSD yet. Although there is some porting work underway to actually reuse this for mobile devices as well. So if you look at our Android port, we spent quite a lot of time building a new Java UI for Android and stuff. And that's all very well, but maintaining lots of different UIs is a bit of a pain, particularly when you need an old style and a ribbon style, and notebook tab thing, and it goes on and on, you know, and you have lots of platforms. So we want to share that. So we're starting to move this to run on iOS as well, and we'll see how that goes. But I think I've lost the thread. Linux. That's pretty much all you need underneath. Yes.
Yeah.
So there are some dependencies.
You're multi-threaded. That's right.
I think you need OpenSSL and a few of those things, but broadly no really complicated dependencies that aren't there. POCO, I suppose, is one C++ library that you do need, and we often provide repositories for that, which is a C++ wrapper around.
Is there a meta package? I asked you about that before, but is there a package that could pull in this for me as I pull in the main
package? I believe so. I think if you install the Collabora Online package, it has all the dependencies you need, and it just sucks the lot in. So that's my hope. Mm. Of course,
awesome.
If you want your Nordic language or your Hindi spell checker, possibly we don't pull those in. Possibly you need to actually manually install those as an additional thing, just to try and keep the size of it as small for most people. It's pretty low in dependencies, and it's all basically a big C++ binary that's mostly self-contained. That's the goal.
Excellent. So I don't think it's a particularly thorny area, but another area we got into during the big discussion at OggCamp was mobile support, and people are asking in the chat room if there is an Android app for this. So what's the score on that?
Yeah, so the way we do collaboration, actually, when you come into the application, is simply to bring everyone into a single process space. So actually, you can almost simulate what we're doing now if you have LibreOffice in front of you on a PC just by going Window, New Window, And what that'll do in LibreOffice is create two views of the same document, not rocket science. But essentially, this is what's going on under the hood when you collaborate in Collabora Online. So, you know, multiple people type in different windows, and we just tie your identity to one of those windows rather than the other. And this does mean that, you know, if you want to collaborate between a mobile device and some PC device, you essentially have to do it online, interactively using Collabora Online. Now, of course, the good news is you can do that on your phone inside this thing, auto-saving every minute. And if and as and when you lose the connection, drop your phone in the river, whatever it happens to be, actually every last character you typed is going to be there, because it's not on your phone in the river. It's on the server over there, which is good, as long as you don't mind buying new phones, I suppose. So that's one way to do it. And otherwise, you would then want a sync client using file syncing from one of your partners, and you know, a local editor to whether that's a LibreOffice on Android or something else like that. If that makes sense.
Go on, carry on. No, I was just going to say the reason that this came up was because when I asked someone this who was pushing. It was kind of a devil's advocate question, because I do push LibreOffice, but they were saying to people, oh, everyone should use LibreOffice. And then when they were asked, does it work on a mobile? They said, oh, it'll work if you've got LibreOffice Viewer, you can view it on your phone. And then somebody else said, but will I see the whole document? And they went, well, it depends how big your screen is, which I'm sorry, to me, is not an effective answer.
Yes, that isn't a very good answer. And I think it's actually not accurate either. So luckily, you know, LibreOffice on Android, you know, you can zoom and pan and pinch and whatever. And interestingly, we actually use similar technology underneath online. So behind the screen, there's a whole load of tiles, which are 256 pixel square pings. And so all of the scrolling and the panning and so on is essentially happening in your browser. There's nothing happening on the server there at all. Mm. And same is true on the mobile device, simply because you just can't get the responsiveness and that feel quick enough when you've got a slow mobile GPU, and you can't get it online either when you've got a latency between you and the server. So it's the same technology essentially used.
So with something like an Android phone now, a decent Android phone and your Chrome browser, your mobile Chrome browser, presumably you could just use, because it's all HTML5 anyway, you could just use it in the browser, I would imagine, and if it scales properly.
Definitely. That's right. So that's what we recommend for mobile. And we're doing we have a 3.4 release coming soon, which has a whole load of latency improvements and also mobile improvements, because the mobile experience is pretty dire at the moment for Collabora Online on mobile. I make no apology for it. It's terrible. But it's significantly improved in 3.4. And at the end of this year, there's another 4.0 release of code that will have much better mobile tweaks in it as well. So exciting stuff.
Excellent. So in our collective goal to, you know, spread free and open source software, I was talking to a lot of friends of mine who work in schools and work in education and stuff, and they were saying about the problem that we have, or the issue that we have, that Microsoft give everything away for free to schools, and you know, let's not get into that. But, you know, so the problem is, as you'll be well aware, that kids leave school knowing how to use Microsoft Office and other Microsoft products. Is there any plans for LibreOffice to kind of challenge that in some way? Because the product's already free. So the problem is, how do we get adoption among young people?
Yeah, so I think free can sometimes be too expensive. And I think we see that in mobile phone operating systems, for example. What you really need is not free, but has a massive kickback scheme related to search and so on. I mean, I think it's not just Microsoft. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for Microsoft in some ways. You know, and I've had a real pleasure working with them, you know, whatever, you know, their past business practices. But Google also give their software away free to school. So I think it's a very challenging market to enter, that one, and particularly because the software, it's not just software they're giving away free. It's also significant server hosting that goes with that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's a huge investment, huge long-term investment in the future of those students from the perspective of trying to get them to use your software. And that's great. If you're a giant company with a huge monopoly, wherever it happens to be, you can cross-subsidize these things easily. But I think for free software, you know, like, well, we already made it free. Now you want us to, you know, provide it. And I think just the economics of free software is very, very, very challenging, particularly in this area of marketing. And freemium is another area that it's very hard to compete in, because if it's open source, some friendly person is going to enable all the features and make a free version with that's unlimited, and perhaps quite rightly so. Who knows? So there are a whole load of economic problems there. And I think, as you say, education is just a bit of a bloodbath. Of course, you still have to lose your data to the machine.
Yeah, it seems to me. So from talking to some people who I know do this sort of thing, education and with technology education particularly, they were saying that they don't really use the Google stuff, but they still heavily use Microsoft. But when they look for alternatives, so the problem is, I know it's not necessarily a problem for you guys because you only have so much bandwidth. And I'm totally sympathetic with the fact that people, you know, businesses are there to make money who are doing that, and they're very smart at doing that, and it makes total sense. But it seems to me what we need is a business to kind of to take, because education in the UK at least has got, it's like the second or third biggest sector in technology now. So there's money there, and Microsoft are already getting some of that. So, and I have no problem with Microsoft, in case people think I do. Sure. Not these days anyway. Yeah, so it seems to me like what we kind of need is another like company to come along and go, we could, you know, train people or maybe even do accreditation and stuff. Because the other thing is Microsoft do really well with accreditation and certification and all that kind of stuff that actually looks really good for the kids when they want to do that. And then they can say, I go into a job and I've got this certificate.
Yeah. So I think one of my problems is that I work for a small company that needs a very clear ROI on what we do. Otherwise, we go bust. And I like employing lots of people to work on free software, and I'd love to have more time myself, but it does mean that, you know, we have to look at these things. So the sort of 10-year horizon of, if we invest in server horsepower and data storage and provide it to a whole lot of kids at a school and support their, you know, IT workers with this new thing, in 10 years we'll get some proportion of them will become IT managers that then recommend.
Mm-hmm.
It's just way outside anything that we can invest in. But the good news, of course, is that Google, at least as they come in, provide the idea that there is an alternative, mm-hmm. and that actually Office suites are not difficult. And it looks a bit different. But, you know, a Mac's different to a PC, is different to a Linux-y thing. And so my hope is that just by creating the space for alternatives, it opens the door to allow us into the conversation. And then once you're talking about it, you know, there are just such huge advantages to having a company that's responsive and actually interested in you as a customer and you actually being important to them, you know, and getting all of that, you know, that goodness and transparency of an open development process and so on, that my hope is these people never leave, right? They come and they don't go. And if you're sticky enough, you know, the growth rate doesn't have to be too huge to you know, ultimately win.
Yeah, and as you mentioned there, actually, from terms of the end user's point of view, if you've used something like Excel, which most people have, one of the things we used to do when I was at university is OpenOffice was big at the time, and it was around. So what we did in order to kind of show people that they could use OpenOffice was we'd put it on their machine. So we'd put it on machines, and then we'd have two machines, one with Microsoft Office and one with OpenOffice, and we'd get them to sit down and we'd give them a list of tasks, like create a spreadsheet that does X, Y, Z, and they do that on the first one, and then they do it on the second one, and we'd ask them which one was harder and which one was easier. And quite often the stuff was fairly intuitive. They could use a spreadsheet, they could use either. So that's kind of the message, I suppose, that we need to get across.
Absolutely. And it's just interesting because we, of course, sell CollaborOffice as well and support for our LibreOffice-based products. And the kind of questions we get when we go and present are really basic, like, does it do VLOOKUPs, the spreadsheet, you know, which is sort of seen as the epitome of difficulty in spreadsheet. It actually probably hits the sweet spot of, it's one of the five formulae that are actually used, and it's probably the most complex formula that most people actively use. And so, yeah, if you can persuade people, actually, yes, VLOOKUPs is really the, you know... We've squashed that one pretty convincingly, and it works great. And what about then complicated matrix formulae with parallel computation? Yeah, we do that too, and then I think you're really winning. So yeah, I think the reality is that Office software, productivity software, is heavily commoditized, increasingly so. And so an alternative that saves you significant money is just very attractive. And you know, we'd love to talk to people that want the confidence and, you know, want someone to hold their hand while they make the jump and make sure that it's a success. And, you know, tell them about other people that have done the same and had a good time too.
So let's talk about the project for a second and also the community. So I presume LibreOffice Online is a separate project from LibreOffice, or am I mixing that up?
Absolutely. So it's built on LibreOffice. It's hosted by the Document Foundation, but it's a separate repository. So it's a, you know, it's a thing you can either have or not have. You don't get it by default when you install LibreOffice.
Well, I mean, the people writing commits stuff, are they committing to LibreOffice online, or are they committing to LibreOffice? Is it the same people for both teams?
Often both. So the reality is that if you add a new feature, often it is on both sides in the LibreOffice core and the LibreOffice online code. And then, of course, at some stage, we ship that as Collabora online. So everything we do goes upstream. We have a sort of open first approach there. And I think there's probably not much of a distinction there except in branding, in services and support, and some of these other pieces, timelines perhaps.
And I just got whispered in my ear, ask about how well this opens up Microsoft files.
Cool. Yeah, so interoperability, I think, is a big chestnut. And I think there are some people out there that claim 100% interoperability. And, you know, if you use XML, the whole problem is solved sort of thing. And that's not my experience. I don't know. I mean, I was involved standardizing, Microsoft's XML formats on the ECMA technical committee. And, Microsoft doesn't interoperate perfectly with themselves between Mac and Windows. And certainly Word Online, just completely bails. It's like, you've got... protected sections in your Word document, we're not even going to bother trying to load it, never mind preserve the content, because we don't know how to deal with this feature. I mean, what do you do if someone edits the unprotected, So at some stage, you need to understand the document structure to be able to interoperate. And so, you need lots of code to do that. You need complexity. The document formats are complex, but we're pretty good. I'd say LibreOffice is the biggest, most mature, best code base out there for interoperating outside Redmond, really. So I'm pretty confident in it, and it gets better all the time. So, get stuck in, try with your files. We run VBA macros, and we also run the VBA. So, unfortunately, our customers give us macros and go, oh, this macro doesn't work. And we're like, you do realize that's using the XL95 compatibility interface that was being deprecated since, XL97 has some, you could go and use this horrible grab bag object for that old compatibility thing. And we still see it out there and have to fix things for these people. But increasingly, working really, really well there.
I seem to recall back when Microsoft started to document their document format, it's because there were certain government institutions that said you have to have a published XML spec for document export. And I remember, I might be mistaken here, but I seem to remember that what they did is they basically put their entire binary blob into like a single tag and said, this is our standard.
I think that's a bit unfair. So I was on the TC there with Brian Jones and all these wonderful people having mud thrown at us. What you described is not completely inaccurate, but it's not entirely accurate either. So one of the things that Microsoft got slammed for was the huge volume of paper that they standardized, 6,000 pages of stuff. And to my mind, still not finished. There's plenty more that needs to be documented in more detail. But, simultaneously, they then complain that it's this sort of under-documented binary thing. So the reality is there are XML tags there. I think from a standards perspective, the job of the technical committee was to improve the documentation, not the file format, which is an interesting standards remit. So with ODF, everything was on the table. We can improve this, we can change the tags, we can change the representation. ODF ended up using a representation that was not the internal representation of LibreOffice. There was significant transforming work done to make that a pretty XML format. I think the same is not true of OpenXML. It really is a pretty good mapping of what was in the binary file format translated into XML, but it is, documented XML. It's much more terse. So it's quicker to parse on one hand and smaller, but not very descriptive. So to each their own. It is what it is. But the TC in ECMA had this remit of improve the description of the standard, but don't change anything about the XML that's produced, which is a shame because there were some obvious blunders in there. But anyway, there we go. It is what it is.
And we actually had a question from the chat room much earlier, and I tried to answer it, but then I realized I don't have the full answer, which is Emily the Strange asked about, what's already delivered, what's actually working right now, and will the rest eventually be delivered?
So I think this has been out there for, you know, we did a whole load of previews of this from late 2015. We shipped it in June 2016. It's been, you know, 2.5 years it's been out there improving and, you know, in quality, performance, memory use, collaborative ability, feature set, and so on. I think it's clear that it's not the full feature set of LibreOffice yet. So we are slowly adding dialogues and improving what functionality is there. But you can expect that to continue, you know, while we have customers, and, you know, while people are contributing. There's a lot more we can expose. So we expose the existing dialogues. And that's another thing. I think you mentioned at the beginning about sharing code between the PC version and the online thing. I think that's vital. So, you know, we add a new feature like pivot charts or something. And wouldn't it be great if that feature then is immediately there on mobile and also, you know, online? And so, yeah, so we reuse those dialogues. So, you know, if you add a feature to the PC LibreOffice, it should be there in the same dialogue in online. And, you know, we're expanding that dialogue surface. But there's all sorts of things. So if you use Draw, for example, you can create 3D objects by extruding arbitrary 2D Beziers into 3D shapes, and then you can light them from 8 different directions with different colored lights. And, you know, this, the UI surface of LibreOffice is vast. It's a million lines of code at least. Because it turns out that although the feature to tweak the layout itself or of a document, say, is it's quite complex to write, it's not very complex, and there are lots of different options to it. And you then have to present those in the UI so the user can, you know, choose to configure those and interoperate, you know, and get the setting that they want. So, you know, people used to come to me and say, what we want you to do is do a Firefox, meaning remove almost all the UI and make it, you know, quicker and slicker. Yeah. So the problem is, and actually, interestingly, if you look at Microsoft Word Online, for example, or Excel Online, you know, if you want to select a border on a cell, you know, you have a pre-canned set of like 8 to 10 options, and that's all you can do. So if you want a thick border underneath, that's easy. If you want it on the left and underneath, that's not easy. Like there's no button for that. If you want a dotted, stippled line, yeah, bad luck. Come back later. So there are a whole load of these pre-canned presets where you select from a palette, but then no rich UI to actually configure that. And actually, we're doing a lot better in Collabra Online. You know, you can really do, there's a depth of functionality there that simply isn't there in some of the competing things. So take Word Online, for example. It's not a WYSIWYG editor, so you can't position images on the page, which is interesting. You know, you can put images in there, you can size them, but where will they end up when you print? Who can say? Similarly, columns. You know, like you can't do columns. Certainly balanced columns or more, you know, exciting stuff like that. Like footnotes. Where is your footnote going to show up, if at all? Who knows? Like, it's not a paginated WYSIWYG editor. And that's quite interesting to lose that, you know? We do all of that. And it's nice to be ahead in, you know, some things.
You would hope if you put a picture on your page that it actually ends up on the printed page somewhere, not just like hanging off the edge or something. Yes.
Yes. I think they probably have extra code to make sure it does show up on the page somewhere. Yes. But exactly where is more of a challenge. So,
the answer is it ends up on the next page, half on one page and half on the next page.
Yeah, right.
Well, when you get a second page you weren't expecting.
That's very true. I think one of the interesting things about print APIs, certainly in browsers, is they're really not very good. And one of our problems is that, you know, if you've ever printed a Google map and you've wondered why the map is like this tiny squatting thing in the top left corner of your page, rather than, say, beautifully filling the page and, you know, except for the margins and so on. Yeah, it doesn't know what your printer is. It doesn't know the page size. It's not able to adapt in any sensible way. It doesn't know what trays it's got, what paper is in it, what, you know, all of those things that you'd really quite like. And that's a bit depressing. So we can generate beautiful PDFs that contain all of the information you want, but we just can't work out what kind of printer you've got, which is, that's a bit annoying. Web browsers should. But still, I hear that web browsers have added a digital sound API in recent years where you can actually generate sound samples and send them to your sound card, which is amazing, huh? Look at that. The technology.
Well, we could probably keep talking. We could probably keep talking for another hour, but we're getting close to the end of the show. So I do have two more technical questions I want to ask, and then I'm going to ask my two standard questions. So the one technical question I have is, okay, so it's a big blob of C++ on the server side, and you said there's some sort of JavaScript layer on the client side. Are you using any kind of framework for that?
gosh, well, it's hard to use JavaScript without using a framework, so we use several. So actually, when you edit the document, why not? You know? So we use Node.js. I guess everyone uses Node for something or other. And then inside that, we use a thing called Leaflet, which is a map library. So actually, just to get something to market, and it turned out to work well, we use a map to render the actual document. So that does the zoom, pan, stuff very nicely. And we try not to use the spherical coordinates in case you have a very big document. and so that's pretty good. But things like your cursor, you know, cursor blinking, I mean, it would be a madness to do a network bandwidth for that. So we have overlays for cursors and selections and object sizing. So that's all snappy and interactive. Does that help?
But are you using something like jQuery or React?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we use jQuery as well. And I was talking to a chap. I was interviewing a JavaScript person. I mentioned we're hiring earlier, did I? The other day. And he was explaining why global variables were bad. And then you say, yeah, but wait a minute. The whole web model is built around this global, massive global DOM with no kind of encapsulation in the scripting language or in the DOM. So anyone can do anything. And they, you know, you have this just, I don't know. I always a bit scared when I read the JavaScript. And you mean he's really searching through for a node with this exact type and that funny name ID and then just fiddling with it in an intimate way? It seems... Anyway, it works. That's the punchline. But
the other concern I have with something this big is testing. What kind of a test suite do you have and what's your code coverage? Is it close to zero? tell me.
So we have automated unit tests that run and hammer our web server pretty heavily and look at all of the IPC, I guess, between what goes to the web front end and what comes to the back end. So between the multiple jails that we have, the web service daemon that sort of multiplexes that, the multiple users and all those things, we're really reasonably confident. I mean, that's pretty good. Of course, there's shed loads of testing goes on the LibreOffice side for security and crash testing and document fidelity and so on. But we take that for granted. Then, as you say, in the JavaScript front-end side, it's more complicated. And we have user testing. There's a test matrix. And, you know, people tell us when it goes wrong. But, we have several release candidates and stuff, and people can get involved in that. But, yes, cool. It's much harder testing.
Okay, now the next is the most difficult question I ever ask a guest because they have to do set math. Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we let you go?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think there's way more we can talk about, you know. But, I think you've asked some good questions. I think there's some new things that are coming, I guess. We talked about some of the mobile things, the latency wins. I think we're pretty good, Randall. You did a good job. Yeah.
And the reason that's difficult is because you have to do set math. You have to think about all the things that you wanted to talk about and then subtract all the things we actually talked about.
Indeed. Well, get involved. Come and get involved. LibreOffice is a fun place to be. You know, it's a great project to get involved with. So let me tell you one thing that's quite interesting. I deal with quite a lot of computer science students as Google Summer of Code students, and I actually just mentored one here. And this guy's been doing a degree in computer science. He's been getting firsts. You know, like he's not an idiot. But when it comes to working on a real piece of software, he struggled massively. And when it comes down to it, it's like, well, yeah, I haven't really dealt with things that are multiple files. You know, I've written lots of clever algorithms. I've passed lots of tests. I've even occasionally written programs that have multiple source code files in them, but I wrote them all, so I know where stuff is. And actually, going and dealing with a big problem, like find the bug in LibreOffice and fix it, requires structured methodology and good process and discipline. And of course it requires the creative flair and spark and inference and all the exciting things that are important in programming. But once you've learned those tools to do that in LibreOffice, and we're, you know, very happy to mentor you on that, I don't think there's anything you can't do. You can sit down and, you know, solve arbitrarily horrible problems. And actually I've got a PDF about that called Solving Arbitrary Engineering Problems. That's perhaps worth a read for any of your computer science guys are listening.
And the great thing is that if you work on open source software, you can point potential employers at, I did this for this project, which is definitely great to have on your resume. So we encourage open source development to everybody for that, because, you know, having stuff like for in the Perl world, having stuff published to the CPAN is quite a credential, because people can go look at your code, see what the history is, things like that. Well, like I said, we're almost out of time. We have two more questions. I really have to get in here or else my audience yells at me. What's your favorite scripting language?
Oh, don't ask me that. I'm. It's going to sound gross if I say Perl, so I'll say Perl. But I'm sort of Pythonizing because I get mocked for using Perl. Look at that, you know?
Perl, of course. Thank you.
If I have to write a short script to do text processing, I will write it in Perl. Yeah.
And what text editor do you use all day?
I'm a middle-aged computer. Well, I'm not a computer scientist, but the editor for middle-aged computer scientists, Emacs.
Yay! That's a double win. It's a double win. I don't get many of those. That's a double win. I'm taking 2 points on today's show. That's awesome.
Sorry, Dan. That is awesome. I mean, I have deep respect for people who use a professional tool, and I've met a lot of programmers that use Notepad, and it doesn't inspire me with confidence.
As much as we slammed Microsoft in this show, maybe not intentionally, I'm now shifted over all of my IDE work, like in Dart and Flutter, to Visual Studio Code, which is beautiful. Mm. It's open source. It's getting better and better with each release. And I'm amazed it came out of the Microsoft camp. It's so bizarre. I'm still trying to get them on to talk about it, but they keep like, I don't know, we miss connections or something like that. I see at every conference I go to, I go up to the Microsoft people. I say, I want to talk to people about code, and they go, I'll take your card, and they never respond back. It's kind of crazy. Anyway, we're out of time. We're really out of time, Michael. It's been great chatting with you. I know a lot more people will know now about LibreOffice Online, and hopefully be able to actually run the Docker image, which I'm still a little sad that I couldn't get it to launch. But thanks for coming on the show and talking to us.
Absolute pleasure to see you guys. Thanks so much.
All right. So that was Michael Meeks talking to us about LibreOffice Online. What do you think there, Dan?
Yeah, fantastic. Obviously, that as you know, we're both kind of heavily in this camp, I think, of having open standards and so on. And I think LibreOffice are doing amazing things. And actually, I do think somebody asked at the very start in the IRC channel, what's the point of putting LibreOffice Online? Everyone who uses Linux already has it. And I think the point is that, you know, to get it out to more than just the core group of people who may be running Linux on a desktop these days, it needs to be in a browser and it needs to be on mobile. And actually, maybe that's the same thing, which is kind of what I was talking about. But yeah, awesome stuff that they're doing. And amazing that they're pushing forward free and open source software in the way that they are.
Well, Dan, thanks for being on the show today, but then being able to talk more about LibreOffice. Like I said, I have it installed on my Mac here somewhere, but I haven't launched it in months or maybe even years. So I don't even know it's probably a really old version too. So and I know I had OpenOffice at one point too, because it was like, that was before it forked, before one of those hostile forks. Anyway, so all right, we're almost out of time. I got to get through the endings here. So next week we have Sanoid. We'll be back on Wednesday again next week. So although we had a Friday show, and this is a Thursday show, we'll be back on a normal Wednesday schedule from here to the end of the year until we get preempted by the trillion-dollar company again, I guess. Sanoid's on next week. It's a policy-driven snapshot management and replication tools, and currently using ZFS for the underlying next-gen storage. So they'll support ButterFS when it finally becomes more reliable. After that, Vaden, I don't know how to pronounce it, two A's in a row, Java-based web development platform. Huh, I think the 90s called. Anyway, we'll see. Let's hope it's modern. Hope it's very modern. After that, Vicky Brasseur, who I saw at the Perl conference a couple months ago, had a great presentation on toxic poisoning of open source communities and what to do about it. But she's going to come on and actually promote her new book called Contributing to Open Source. And I think I know a lot of people here have wanted a generic sort of what's open source, what are the philosophies behind it, stuff like that. I think this is going to be the show you want to tune in on. It also happens to coincidentally be our 500th show, Floss Weekly's 500th show. So the timing for that worked out wonderfully perfect. After that, Sway, which is a tiling Wayland compositor and drop-in replacement for the i3 window manager for X11. I know what none of that means. Hopefully I'll get somebody who knows Linux desktop on that show. OpenRhein-Ruhr, which is the I hope I'm pronouncing that right. The German open source 2-day conference in early November. Monero is coming back after they canceled a while back. Cryptocurrency, but private, untraceable, unfungible. So those of you who wanted us to be this week in blockchain, we at least have one episode coming soon. Tidelift, which gives maintainers and core teams a way to get paid for doing the work they love. Tidelift provides the tools and audience necessary for them to deliver a professional software experience. Looking forward to that one as well. We still have a few open slots, I think, in Q3 now, is it? What quarter are we in? Anyway, starting to be up there. You can go to twit.tv/floss, the homepage for this show, to look at past episodes. You can also follow the link there to the big spreadsheet on who's coming up. If there's somebody you want on that list that isn't on that list, please have the project leader or community coordinator email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My email's there on the page. So you don't have to write that down. Just go to the page, twit.tv/floss, and there's my email address right there. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, usually on Wednesdays. It was Thursday today, and it was 4 p.m. last Friday, because that's just when we had. We take a number of questions from the chat room, Emily the Strange, of course, and I forget who else we took. Maybe nobody else. Anyway, Emily's a regular in the chat channel. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. I will be in all things open in what's left of Raleigh after the hurricane in October. So hopefully there'll still be some Raleigh left there. I guess the hurricane's coming straight at that area. So we'll see. Hopefully they're a little bit in inland. So hopefully it won't be too bad. I'll be in Siegel in Seattle in November as press. Oh, by the way, I'm also going to be speaking my Flutter talk at All Things Open. They graciously granted me a slot for that. So, and I'll be at KubeCon in December, which is all about Kubernetes, and that's also in Seattle. So I'll be in Seattle a couple times in the next 3 months or so. Anything you want to plug, Dan, quickly?
Yeah, very quickly. Listen to Tales of the Unattested, not Tales of the Unit Tested, which we're going to do later, Randall. But Tales of the Unattested is a new podcast I'm doing. If you like comic books, movies, and life, we talk about basically. So that covers pretty much everything. You can find it at unattested.podfactory.org or search for it.
Cool. And as you said, not unit tested. I was actually drinking, so I did a spit take. So I had to sort of wipe my face off real quick. So good thing I was facing that way and not looking at that. Did I show the surfer yet? So there's a surfer dude on the screen. Right. Isn't that cool? All right. Enough wasted time. Dan, thanks once again for joining me on this show and providing your expertise. Always welcome.
No problem.
All right. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.